You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code SMARTESTDOC to get a 5% discount. Today's podcast is a super exciting one for several reasons. Today, I'm going to be the guest, and my friend, colleague, and outstanding functional medicine practitioner, Dr. Dana Cohn, the author of Fuel Up and Quench, she's going to be asking me the tough questions, so I have to get ready. So I am excited to welcome my friend, Dr. Dana Cohn, back on the podcast and let her interview me.
I'm so honored. Thank you. I feel like Joan Rivers to your Johnny Carson.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
We're dating ourselves. So I'm just going to jump in, and I think I'm going to go sort of, you know, get the highlights of each chapter one by one. I wrote a list of questions, and I'm going to read the questions. I'm not used to hosting, so bear with me.
Okay.
We're going to start. First of all, let's start with the beginning. Why another book on Candida? William Crook's book, The Yeast Connection, is a classic in the field. I remember it was required reading when I first worked for Dr. Atkins in 1998.
Oh, wow. I mean, he was actually an allergist, and so we have that similar background, but he was crucified by the allergy and medical community. And, you know, he only found a home a little bit among the slowly evolving holistic or functional medicine doctors.
I remember reading it too and thinking like that, this, we didn't learn this in medical school. Like, No. What is this about Candida? You know, it was, I remember thinking at the time until I started treating it. And when you start to treat it, you start to realize, wow, there's something here. Like, this is really changing people's lives. So, has anything changed in the 50 years since you wrote the
book? Yes, Dr. Cohn, a lot, you know, and that's why I decided to write the book, because Dr. Crook, being a really good clinician, was diagnosing what he was observing. He was having all these patients come with these multitude of symptoms, which no particular specialist wanted to see, and they were falling into his lap. And he was treating him, which we can get into, with his Candida diet, which people like abhor or afraid of, or they thought was crazy back then, and now it's cool, as I tell patients, to be like gluten or, you know, dairy free. But he didn't know anything about the microbiome, because medicine didn't know about the microbiome. And that's what's really changed. So, and again, it's interesting, through the podcast and some of the guests that I've interviewed, like Mark Pimentel and Dr. Satish Rao, people I mentioned very early on in the book, have helped us understand the microbiome. And this is the big difference. So it really brings a lot of, I think, scientific validity to this condition.
Yeah, I find that so true in so many things we do in functional medicine. You know, as the years go by, the acceptance starts to come much later. You know, think about vitamin D. How long have you been testing vitamin D and talking about vitamin D? Now it's commonplace. Before we were ostracized about doing something like that. Okay, so the first chapter in the book is titled Candida Confusion, or Candida. What is the confusion about Candida, and who is confused? Patients, us doctors, or both?
Just to preface it, you know, I kind of always enjoy when I read a book, if there's like a little bit of a quote before you read the chapter, and that it hopefully has a connection. And I heard this line from Dean Ornish, so I have to, you know, I don't know where he got it from, because I don't think he came up with it, but The quote says, "You could always recognize the pioneers by the arrows sticking out of their backs." It's like in the cartoons, you know, you see like the Indians shooting the arrows and the pioneer was, you know, running away. And that kind of what happened in what happens in medicine. You know, you are if you're the beginning of something new, people, you know, with that old saying too, they all disagree with you, they fight you until they accept you, that whole thing. But I think the candidate confusion, and it's understandable among especially our conventional medical colleagues, was that candida can only be a problem in like one of two areas. Either you are immune compromised, like HIV or a chemotherapy patient, or maybe a woman with vaginitis. And I know, and you and I both know something about this because when I stepped on the hospital ward right out of medical school in 1986, I immediately was taking care of 20 AIDS patients on the floor. It was just overwhelming. They were unfortunately all dying every week from some immune compromising infection. And Candida was one of them, or it made them extremely uncomfortable. They had what's called thrush, a white tongue that could even extend down their esophagus. They had other horrendous immune compromising issues, such as pneumocystis carinii, pneumonia. So I think for a really long time, especially after AIDS, doctors felt Candida, you know, these opportunistic issues could only be relevant if you were immune compromised. Not thinking that the quote normal population could suffer from something like this, and for sure that it couldn't give all these different symptoms. So I think the doctors were very confused, and in relationship to that, the patients were because they wouldn't get validated. They might have picked up Dr. Crook's book and gone to a doctor and say, "I have all of these symptoms. I think I have candida." And the doctor would roll his eyes and say, "That's nonsense." And then the patient walked out, you know, with their head down saying, "I must be making this up."
Or the doctor, or you'd be sick as a dog, you know. And I just want to, you know, we're clarifying there is a difference between systemic candida versus what we're sort of talking about here. So it's funny because I do have patients still to this day that walk in and say, "I have systemic candida. That's what I'm here for." And I'm like, "Well, you don't, and you need to be careful about who you say that to."
That's right. No, the language is important. And one of the things I've emphasized in the book is, and this is also the big confusion that, and we're going to get into this, I hope, in the other chapters, it's essentially candida overgrowth. It's not an invasive infection. I mean, I would see, you know, again, when I was working in my days in the hospital, a patient that unfortunately had like a leukemia or something and was on very heavy doses of chemotherapy medications. And unfortunately, with their being in a very immune compromised state, they could get some type of fungal like Candida or Aspergillus invasive infection, which was deadly. But the patients that we're seeing in our practices have essentially what I call Candida overgrowth. And we'll get into why somebody would have that. But that's a totally different thing. And I, you know, when you and I speak to other doctors, honestly, you know, because we know they'll say, "Oh, Dr. Mitchell's treating Candida, you know, he must be a quack or whatever, too." And then once in a while, I'll reach out and talk to that doctor. And I really, honestly, after 10 minutes, they're like, "Oh, I didn't realize that. That's what you mean." You know, so you're right, language is important.
So we'll talk about, I guess, like SIFO versus,
Yes, we will.
you
We
know,
will
and which
hopefully
is the
get
new
into it very
term that I'm
soon.
so happy. Yes. All right. So let's go on to the next chapter. In the second chapter, you discuss the microbiome's role in Candida. Can you explain what is the microbiome and what happens when Candida gets out of control? So
Yeah.
Candida overgrowth.
You know, and I'll probably can't help myself here. I like a lot of times use the quotes. You know, Louis Pasteur, the famous French chemist, immunologist, was quoted supposedly saying on his deathbed, colleague, Nobel Prize winner, said to him, you know, because Louis Pasteur was famous for discovering the rabies vaccines and, you know, pasteurization. He goes, "But it's the soil, not the seed." And what I want the listeners to know by that, meaning, it's really your own immune system, your makeup, you know, that really is the big difference in overcoming illness. Because some will recover relatively well, others will be devastated by it. And it really does have to do to some degree of their nutrition status. You know, what I discuss in the book is about the microbiome. I mean, obviously it's getting more and more attention these days from doctors and researchers. And we're understanding that, you know, we are a composite of the bacteria, viruses, even parasites, nobody likes to think about that, and fungi that live within us normally. And when this gets out of balance, That's where the problems begin. And one of the people I interviewed on my podcast twice, once just a few months ago, is Dr. Mark Pimentel. He's at UCLA. He's really not only one of the top GI specialists, and he's the one who really kind of discovered SIBO, small
Yeah.
intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which the test is done, thousands of times a week probably. But what Dr. Pimentel pointed out to me and in his work, because he's really on the cutting edge of this, is that a diverse microbiome is what makes somebody have a healthy microbiome and a healthy immune system. It's when the microbiome becomes homogeneous that the problems begin. And just to use a little, throw in a little medical term here, a lot of the reasons that our microbiome becomes homogeneous is iatrogenic. Unfortunately, the doctors have induced this with medications such as chronic antibiotics, chronic acid blocking medications, which are very powerful, the proton pump inhibitors. Again, the women that use the birth control pill. So this was really, to me now, the science, which Dr. Crook didn't have at the time, that was explaining, wow, this is why a problem is happening. And Candida is a Candida is a hardy organism. You start knocking out all the other ones, it's what's left. And when it's left alone and overgrows, problems
Yeah.
begin.
Yeah. So I think that's an important point that part of when you're thinking about Candida, thinking about how long have that person been on birth control pill? Were they ever on steroids, antibiotics? I always ask about antibiotics in childhood. I also ask about how were they born? Were they born vaginally or
Right.
C-section? Were they born, to a sterile environment with that and not getting their mother's, vaginal microbiome? So yeah, that is important to think about from a doctor's standpoint. Can somebody actually fix their microbiome?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I believe they can. I mean, well, I'd like to get into that later on because it's kind of the protocol that I discussed in the book. It's definitely very doable. I've treated thousands of patients for this and seen, fortunately, really good results. So yes, I think the good news is you can restore your microbiome. It just takes a little work and I think support from a position that's willing to work with you.
I just want to go back to that term diversity that you said earlier. Diversity is such an interesting word in nature. I think nature always, in every way, looks towards diversity. Diversity in our diets, diversity in our microbiome, diversity, So I think it's an interesting word to think about. So going back, Candida, as you mentioned, is always questioned as a real diagnosis. So how does a patient or a physician know that they really have Candida? Is there a specific test in the blood or urine or stool even that they can do?
Yeah, I think that's been the biggest Achilles heel of diagnosing Candida. I understand patients and physicians like a test, a really clear-cut test like we have with like celiac disease now, with blood checking antibodies in the blood that give you a diagnosis. And unfortunately, that doesn't still exist yet for Candida. And that's what makes it tricky because I do still feel it, like in Dr. Crook's day, it's a very clinical diagnosis. That's why I have in chapter 3 about the 15 candidate directed questions. I found them to be so useful because if a patient answers yes to even just a few of them, that already gets my antennas up. Because and we'll get into this later on. I don't see every patient say, oh, you have candida. I'm very discerning. I want to make sure. But if your history meets the criteria, and unfortunately today, and that's, I think, starting to change. You know, I see so many young patients in their 20s and 30s that have this, which is a little disheartening. And so many of them have a history of, oh, I was on tetracycline for 6 months for acne. Oh, I was on antibiotics for 6 months or a year for Lyme disease. Oh, I had a lot of sinus infections and the ear, nose, and throat doctor always gave me cortisone and antibiotics. And then there tends to be always like this perfect storm. You know, either they have a lot of stress in their life or, you know, something comes together and they start to get really sick. And that's what typically ends up bringing them to, you know, to my office.
Yeah,
just to mention too, because you brought it up, you know, I have people all the time say, what about my stool? Well, the stool is not that useful. Again, Dr. Pimentel makes a great analogy. He says you wouldn't, you know, you really wouldn't check your garbage to know what you had for dinner. The large intestine where the stool comes out is just not really a good representative of the microbiome or finding candida. Urine, indirectly, but not great. And blood, you know, I've been reading some papers more recently now about the immunoglobulin antibodies, but I'm still not comfortable enough to say that would help me make diagnosis. I really rely on the questionnaire that I use in the book.
Yeah, so I think just to clarify, it is a clinical diagnosis,
yes,
meaning we don't have a specific blood test and it's up to you and the doctor to sort of rule out everything else, anything that would be obvious, and then sort of get to, well, this is possibly candida, and go through the questionnaire.
And, you know, again, we'll get into this later on too. Typically, you know, when I have a high suspicion, when I treat these patients, it only takes 2 or 3 weeks and I know if they're responding.
Yeah, so diagnosis by treatment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. you know, I think the general public thinks of candida and yeast infections as the same thing, in the sense that only women can get them when they have vaginitis. Is that true? And what are some other symptoms of patients with candida overgrowth? And is vaginitis a symptom of a gut overgrowth of candida?
You know, I did also think candida only happened in women who had vaginal yeast infections. Although I did start to see, obviously, men with AIDS that had thrush in my practice. But, you know, the more I ended up getting to functional medicine and opening my eyes and recognizing these patients that I was missing, especially with the chronic sinus patients, you know, that so many of them, it's due to candida. And I always tell patients, they get a little bit of a smile, because I always love to go back to my medical school days. I remember when I was in pathology, that when they used to do the slides, when you look under the microscope to see the different tissue, that the vaginal tissue and the sinus tissue were almost identical. And they used to try to fool you which one was which. And it turns out also the microbiome are very similar, believe it or not, in some ways. So this started really changing my mindset, how to look at this condition.
Yeah, the chronic sinusitis being, you know, yeast problems is very interesting. And I do think it's still way underdiagnosed.
Yeah, our ENT colleagues don't really, I don't know. I know some, but a lot of them don't still get it. And unfortunately, they're fueling the fire because so many of the patients, you know, they're uncomfortable. Either they get a surgery or they get another round of antibiotics or steroids. And I always tell my patients, unfortunately, what I see is that with the antibiotics and steroids, it's one step forward. They get a little relief temporarily, and it's three steps backwards.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I don't know why they don't. Well, question about that, though. Do you think that, not biopsying, but culturing sinuses, that they don't, would that pick up yeast?
Well, that's an interesting thought. You know, sometimes it's hard to get to that tissue. You know, one of the actually really important studies that got really, they thought caused a lot of controversy, was actually from the Mayo Clinic. And I still hold to this paper because I think it's important. I've got the name of the original author, but basically it was an ENT group. And what they did was they had done about 100 surgeries on patients. And so they had surgical specimens and they sent them off for culture. And like 70% of these patients were growing out fungi, and candida was definitely one of the main ones. So I thought that was like really important because, yeah, you're not normally going to, we'll get into this later too, with the gastroenterology stuff. You're not normally going to do such invasive procedures to make a diagnosis. I mean, hopefully down the line we'll have better testing, which I have suggestions for. I just have to find someone to come up and do it. I think you'll find it interesting. But But yeah, I mean, I think there's like these little hints of proof, but and we have to go on that.
All right, next chapter. We're going on to chapter four. You discuss the diagnostic stages of Candida. Where did this come from, and how is it helpful in treating a patient?
So again, my quote, I'm gonna have to go back to Dr. Pasteur again. In the fields of observation, chance favors the prepared mind. I remember one of my medical school professors saying that line when we first started. And I was like, what does he mean by that? It takes a little while till something seeps in. And really it means, and I teach this to the medical students, is that if you're not looking for something, with open eyes, you're going to miss it. And I don't know about, I'm sure like yourself, like over the years, you think like, oh gosh, you're going to be this master clinician and see a rash and make a diagnosis. No, you have to look at hundreds of photos of rashes and do that kind of training to keep your eyes open to what you may see. It's not going to just hit you in the face. You got to be looking or thinking. That's the way I look at it. And that's kind of what happened though in taking care of all of these Candida patients that started coming to our practice. I started to see the and stage these different symptoms. I mentioned in the book essentially four stages that then it's not perfect, but it's uncanny how often patients have a combination or I see them sequence through these stages, like where initially it's the gut, which again, where the microbiome issue is. Dr. Alessio Fasano at Harvard, he used to be at Maryland, one of the probably most famous celiac physicians in the world. He was the one who really showed the whole idea about leaky gut and intestinal inflammation in celiac patients. And this was really important because it helped explain why celiac patients don't just, again, when we were in medical school, there was about two paragraphs about celiac disease being in pediatric patients, if you remember. That's what I remember. And all of a sudden you get into practice and I'm diagnosing or seeing patients, adults, that have celiac disease. And a lot of them didn't even have GI symptoms or nothing dramatic. This idea of the leaky gut, of the gut, which is only one cell thick compared to our skin, which is seven layers thick. It's easy for what we call antigens and proteins to sneak out there that are not supposed to leave the gut. And we know, and I know from my infectious disease training, when an organism, a microorganism gets in the wrong place where it's not supposed to be, that's where trouble begins. Like people always worry about, E. coli in your gut. E. coli, there's plenty of E. coli in your gut. When it gets into your urine too much, then you got a urinary infection. So anyway, to go through the stages, what I saw was initial stage was the gut stage. The second stage I call it leaky gut. What I typically see is the women get vaginitis, and women get sinusitis. I've seen a lot of urticarial hive-like rashes that have cleared up by treating underlying Candida when again the appropriate underlying factors. And then the deeper stages I've seen, what I call stage three, is the brain fog. And I explain that it's very interesting when Candida is really circulating and as an overgrowth, it actually the yeast turns. When you have sugar and other things like that, it turns it into alcohol and acetaldehyde in the brain. So that's why you get that brain fogginess. And the fourth condition, which I was like, a lot of these patients with severe chronic fatigue, a good proportion of them had Candida overgrowth. And once we treated that, their fatigue improved. So that's, again, something I think in my book that's kind of special, from my own clinical experience and pulling together some of the science from really top, researchers.
Yeah, I really love how far we've come since Dr. Crook's book. It's
Yeah.
empowering in many ways. In chapter five, you have Dr. Mitchell's protocol to conquering Candida. So, what
Yeah.
does this involve? Why is it different from Dr. Crook's original plan?
Yeah. Very arrogant of me to put my name on a protocol, right? But I always said I wanted to be known for a treatment, not a disease. So maybe
There you go.
I got my wish.
I love it.
And again, I like the quote I used at the beginning of this chapter. I go, this is from Eddie Cantor. He was a very famous comedian back in the day. He goes, it took me 20 years to become an overnight success. And that's a little bit how I felt about treating Candida. When I first started doing this, I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. I would turn to my wife Ricky and get some guidance and I was always seeking out other experts, and it was kind of hard to find. I get bits and pieces, but from doing this work for a really long time, you hopefully, if you learn from your patients, you get better and better at this. And another person I really have to credit, who unfortunately has passed away several years ago, was like Anne Borick. She wrote something called The Candida Cure. I got to know Anne. She actually spent some time in my office when she moved to New York for a while from California. She was like a naturopath. She wasn't a medical doctor, but she had a very strong reputation. And I think she knew Dr. Cook also. She apparently suffered from very severe cancer herself and multiple sclerosis. And part of her book was treating herself to get better. But what I learned from Anne was interesting. She obviously was a proponent of the diet, which all of us are. We know having too much sugar in your diet's not good. She felt strongly that avoiding dairy and a lot of the wheat-based products was important as well. But another funny thing I learned from Anne, and of course I have patients follow the diet, especially in the beginning intensively, was that vitamin therapy was important. Because what I was finding when I first started doing this, that a certain percentage of my patients were getting the dreaded Herxheimer reaction or the die-off reaction, and I didn't really understand why. Because a lot of times I would go quickly into antifungals, which we'll get to, and I think it was just too much for their system. So I remember having a conversation with Anne when she was in California, and she said to me, Dean, if you treat these patients with vitamin therapy, like if you have access to IV vitamins or injections, you can really cut down these Herxheimer reactions. And she was right, because it's rare, it still will happen occasionally, but much less often than it did initially.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I learned from Anne. And the other components, really, that one person I have to credit a lot to is Dr. Marjorie Crandell, who has her own great book, which I've had her on my podcast called Overcoming Yeast Infections. I mean, she mainly does deal with the vaginitis, but she was a microbiologist, but she was a candida sufferer herself for decades. And she really understood also the antifungals and how they were underused. And I learned a lot from her. And the last thing, again, I draw on my experience on doing sublingual immunotherapy, because I've been a proponent of that for 25 years. I haven't given an allergy shot in 25 years. And I wrote the book on that back in the day. But I end up using and applying for Candida. And I found that by doing that, two things we try to accomplish. One, to get people off the antifungals, because the antifungals work as long as you give them. And while some of them can be safe, you don't want to take that forever. And the immunotherapy helps boost their own immune system. And
Do you think part of that is that patients actually have an allergy to can that some patients have an allergy
some
to
people say
candida?
that. I just feel that I feel more you're building up these protective antibodies, it's keeping it in check. That's my
Okay.
best assessment at this point. And I also, the other point too is, as hard as the Candida diet is, I want to give patients the ability to expand their diet. And I think once they rebalance their microbiome, like we talked about earlier, that they can. I mean, I mentioned probably in the book, I'm a card-carrying member. I mean, for many years, I had a lot of digestive problems. And once I did a lot of this work on myself, I feel much better. And do I cheat every once in a while? Yes, I do. And I enjoy it. But I don't overdo it. And again, try to, get that balance.
Yeah. I always tell patients too, I think, this diet is not forever. But there's a life cycle of candida. So the thing is, once you recognize that, oh, I think my candida is out of control, then you get really strict again, and it may involve seeing you again and doing some
That is such
antifungals
a
and
great point. Thank
yeah.
you for mentioning that because, okay, so people always ask the questions. They always ask, like, how do I kill this candida? Will it come, ever come back? Those kind of things. And what I've seen in my practice is that patients get better, and that it doesn't take too long, which is nice.
Yeah.
Then sometimes I don't see them for years, and then I get a call, Dr. Mitchell, it's back. Okay, it's like, what happened? And the two things I've seen is, I had this procedure. I had to go on antibiotics, a dental procedure. I was on two, 3 weeks, and there was another complication, another 2, 3 weeks. I said, oh, you should have reached me because I would have put them on antifungals at the same time. That's actually what Dr. Crook did, way ahead of his time. He used to put people on nystatin when they were on antibiotics back in the day.
Yeah.
And the other thing, a big mistake I see with patients, and we'll get to this maybe in the later diet chapter, is that, people are doing so well, and then I said to him, what's going on? Like, why? What do you think the real? I don't know. I go, I'm so healthy. I'm eating all these fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut and kombucha. I said, that's not good for a candida patient. Their gut just doesn't tolerate that.
Yes, it's the one place I think that it's not good.
It's not
Yeah,
good. So,
yeah.
and we fix them up again, but they get a little nervous.
Yeah. So you and I are both functional integrative medical doctors, and we believe in natural therapies when possible. You did mention nystatin. So I do want to talk about which antifungals. So first part of the question is, what antifungals would you use, and do you have a preference? And then what's your opinion of different herbs and supplements used to treat candida, like Pau d'Arco or garlic, caprylic acid, coconut oil? And then just last part of that question is, do they need to be careful with herbs,
Yeah,
some of those herbs?
you do. I think so. Okay, so that's a really good question. And again, I learned a lot from Dr. Crandell and all this. I think also, again, a big difference was Dr. Crook didn't have access to anything besides nystatin, which was okay, but nystatin only works in the gut. It doesn't really get to the outside of the gut, candida. Although a lot of his patients still improved with the vaginitis, which was nice. But today, Diflucan, which is, widely used for candida vaginitis, it's just underused. Doctors, unfortunately, too, I guess I understand this, but they're really fearful of antifungals. So they'll give patients like 3 pills. And Dr. Crandell used to yell about this. She goes, you are undertreating patients big time. They need at least 2 or 3 weeks because candida gets in deep in the tissue and you're just getting the surface stuff. And it's funny because I'm more afraid of antibiotics than I am of antifungals.
Completely, completely, yeah.
So I've learned from her too a combination of things. Like if somebody is resistant to Diflucan, which sometimes they can be if they've been given it frequently, I'll go to other things like itraconazole or combine it with terbinafine. There are ways of doing it, and there's some of the newer antifungals which are very effective. They're just very expensive. So I try to get by with that first line or two, but I have used the stronger ones. And it's interesting too because I interviewed Tom Chilin from the CDC, who's like head of the fungal branch there, and he deals with some of the most wicked fungal infections, respiratory and everything. And we were talking about medications, and he uses doses 2 to 3 times higher than what I would typically use in my patients. And he says he really sees a problem because people are always worried about my liver gonna be okay. And I'm like,
Yeah.
I've done this with thousands of patients, and I think I saw one case with a patient who had colitis, the liver was off a little bit. It's very rare.
Yeah, with specifically with Diflucan, you're speaking about nystatin, it's not an issue.
Not even a thought. Next time you can give to pregnant women, you don't have to even
Yeah.
think really too much.
I just want to say on the same note though, there are some herbs though that can, like caprylic
Yeah, no
acid,
herbs.
high
Yeah.
doses long term. And patients, these are over the counter. Patients think they have candida, I'm going to treat it, and they're taking large doses of caprylic acid on their own. That is something that is a little, it should be checked. I've never seen it in my almost 30 years of practicing, but it is something that exists, and patients need to be a little careful about.
I think people have to be so careful. First of all, I hate to say this, but I see a lot of patients that sometimes come to me from out of state who've been on the candida diet, have been on herbs, just really self-treating for years, and they get slightly better. That's one disappointing aspect of it. Another disappointing aspect or scary aspect is, like you said, I always tell my patients, I said, the most dangerous medications you can take are the over-the-counter medications or herbs, because if you're really not being monitored, and you don't even know the interactions between one or the other, you're really working blindly. And I don't like to work blindly. You know, if people really like these things, what I'll tell them is, once you're rebalanced, if you want to use it, in small amounts, that should work. But otherwise, I don't, I'm not a naturopath, I'm not an expert on herbal medicine, but I, again, in all my years of seeing patients on it, I haven't seen anything miraculous. And where the medications and the diet and the vitamin treatments and my immunotherapy drops seem to really, I call, move the needle.
So in chapter seven, you bring up the connection between Candida and MCAS, which is mast cell activation syndrome. This is, I send all my MCAS patients to you. both have been controversial diagnoses, as we know. So, but how are they connected? And can you explain what is MCAS to the listeners?
I mean, it's really getting to that whole thing about keeping your eyes open. I trained, oh God, 40 years ago when I did my fellowship in New York City in allergy and immunology and infectious disease. I remember, I think, even doing a presentation on mast cells. And this is the funny thing, Dr. Cohn. When I had to do the presentation on it, I went really all in depth about mast cells. Mast cells were thought to be like only allergy related cells. Like mast cells were only important if you had allergies. And I remember thinking over the years, just a little bit, my free time, like, why would God invent a cell just to torture allergy patients? I mean, this, it's gotta do something else, right? And then unfortunately, sure enough, God spoke. And unfortunately, the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and so many of us were seeing patients with this quote long haul COVID. And I think it's going to really pan out, and it's being more and more understood that essentially long COVID, possibly chronic Lyme, a lot of other conditions, and I know this for toxic mold because I see a lot of toxic mold patients. What they're doing is they're activating mast cells. And mast cells are not just an allergy cell. They're actually what I explain to patients. They're a primary immune cell. They're like what we call our patrol cells. They're patrolling around when you get a cut on your hand, when you get an infection. They're the first ones that get involved and respond. Later on, they bring in the T cells and the B cells and everything else, but they work immediately. But, and again, I make this analogy too, if they're always like on fire, if the stove is always turned up on high, you're going to feel awful because they're releasing all of these different type of mediators that make you itch, make you feel pain. So what I've seen, again, in treating COVID patients, treating toxic mold patients, and now I believe in Candida patients, that their symptoms overlap, and that can't be a coincidence. So I try to explain to patients, I can stabilize your mast cell activation, but I can really help you if I treat or identify the underlying problem, and treat that, and then your mast cells go back to being quiet. I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
That's a great explanation of it. I love it. Chapter nine has what I believe is a very important place in this book. You go through the other diagnoses that should be excluded before assuming a patient has Candida. I spoke a little bit about this earlier. So what are the key takeaways of chapter nine?
I, again, the, unfortunately, in medicine, it's very easy to, I forgot what they call it. Was it, there's a name for the type of bias it is. Was it relative bias or something? Like when you see something, so the next patient you see thinks he has that also, and then the next patient. In medicine, I did have a really good teacher at Columbia who used to say, especially when he was seeing a recurrent patient, he used to really have to take that moment and say, I got to look at this with fresh eyes. And also, I always, there's also that analogy, like, just because you have a hammer doesn't mean everything's a nail.
I think of that with Lyme patients. I rarely send a patient that I think has Lyme to an integrative Lyme specialist because that's all they see, and they have bought themselves a year worth of
I
antibiotics
agree with you.
without even walking through the door.
I agree. I think it's more harmful than helpful, but it's, again, my personal opinion.
I
But
mean,
yeah,
there's a
so
place for it, but
right.
that's
I
exactly
think
why
in the
it is
right
that bias.
situations, but yes, I agree with you. That is that's one of the things too I love about the work that we do, and why I don't just do, I mean, like, one of the things in my practice too, I do the sublingual food allergy desensitization, which I love because You have these kids, and sometimes adults that are highly allergic, anaphylactic to peanuts and tree nuts. And I desensitize them to the point where if they have an accidental ingestion, they don't, they're protected. But I wouldn't want to just do that only in my practice. It's just, I guess it loses my interest, and I feel like that doesn't keep me as sharp in other things. So, and one of the things about Candida, which is interesting, if you really, do the thorough evaluation, it is interesting because you're trying to figure out what else could be in there. And I mentioned, I have a couple of interesting case histories in that, in this chapter, about people with other diagnoses that could mimic Candida. And so again, you and I both as physicians, you see, we have an advantage. One of the, it's really funny, one of the, near my office in Long Island, there was a really good health food store. And I used to like to go there for lunch. And I used to like to talk to some of the people who worked there. They were very knowledgeable. And I'd see them. I used to sit there at the counter drinking my smoothie or juice or something, and they're busy like talking to these people at the counter like they're the doctor. I just sat quietly, and I kept on saying to myself, like, okay, I was listening to some of the knowledge that they were dispersing, and some of it was very reasonable, very good. But then on the other hand, I kept on thinking to myself, I don't know if that person has a like an iron deficiency anemia. They don't know if this person has this. You and I as physicians can order blood testing or urine testing or do diagnostic radiology and make sure we're not missing some other treatable condition, because that would be god awful. Somebody at government has a cancer or a colitis, and you're telling them, oh, you just have Candida.
Yeah, it makes me think about too. I'll say this to patients when they walk in the door, and the first thing they say to me is, I have candida. I've seen every known doctor. And I stop them and I say, listen, I want to do you a favor. Just give me your symptoms. Let me,
Right. Don't get
because
put a label on yourself.
you're already influencing me, and now that's all my mind is going to think
Yeah.
about. So anybody, any patients that are listening, start by just telling your symptoms, and then I'll always say to them, I want to hear your theories. I want to hear them at the end, but right
Right.
now I want you to
Right.
just not influence what could be, because we
A
don't
hundred
know,
percent.
and you
A
don't
hundred
know. Yeah.
percent. It's right. I mean, when people get labeled or they label themselves, which is even worse,
Yeah.
you're not doing, And part of, I'm sure what you enjoy and I enjoy too, I love being a medical detective, so
Yeah.
I want the clues, the hints. I don't want, if I knew the answer already, we knew the answer already, it wouldn't make it as interesting. And
Yeah.
but it's also just good medicine, because yeah, there could be a lot of misdiagnoses, and that's something we never want to happen.
Chapter 10. So the diet people love to hate.
Yeah.
And it is, I will say, it's a tough diet. I'll tell people right up front. This is one of the more restrictive diets I give to
Yeah.
people. However, I always say it's going to change your life. And it
Yeah.
really, really can. So, has the diet changed? And what's your approach to the diet to make it work?
Well, I will say this. It's the way you look at it a little bit, because one of the things that have made life a little bit easier, people are going to healthier diets now overall. I mean, the educational level is definitely increased. I mean, back in the day, if you told people to avoid, to eat this kind of diet, avoiding wheat and this and that, they were like, you're crazy, you're a weirdo, and now all the celebrities, the athletes, they're following some kind of variation of this diet, and it also keeps them slim. Maybe I don't need the GLP-1 drugs as much. But I do start out with saying the restrictions in the beginning, because I have to be upfront, and I think they're not unreasonable. I tell people, look, the processed sugar, get that out. It's not good for anybody. It's just, destroying your body. Cheeses, I'm a little bit flexible, though. Again, in the beginning, I'm a little bit strict also. For whatever reason, I don't think we really fully understand it. It does affect the microbiome. The grains also limited to some degree. I mean, only because people eat so much bread, and I also warn patients really clearly, the gluten-free products and breads and all that are probably the worst thing you can have. They're all processed corn, potato starch, rice starch. You're better off if you're really not celiac, which most people aren't. I do have them restrict the alcohol in the beginning, especially when we're trying to rebalance the microbiome. So that
Oh,
part hasn't. What?
all
Well, just the
alcohol.
first 4 or 5 weeks, especially when I'm using
Okay.
the stronger antifungals. Later
Okay.
on, we're going to get to this. What I ask the patients to think about is this, and I think this is the understanding with Candida. We want a low glycemic diet. No, because
Bottom
sometimes
line.
too people get the wrong impression. They go, oh, I can't have sugar. It means I can't have fruit. Well, no, you can have apples and berries and a little bit of grapefruit. They're low glycemic fruits. I wouldn't have cantaloupe or watermelon, that kind of pineapple in the beginning, because you don't
Banana.
want your blood sugar to rise. Apparently, that could feed into the yeast. I mean, what people didn't realize, but it was actually a very good book, Wheat Belly, I think by Dr. Davis, where he talks about, I mean, people don't realize how much your blood sugar spikes from wheat products. And that's the whole thing. I mean, because Candida is an organism, it feeds on yeast, it doesn't feed on fat or protein. So by limiting that, That's really helpful. The other thing I kind of, this is what I've kind of been a big advocate of, is fiber. I like to say fiber is your friend. And that's why I like even myself every morning, I have ground flaxseed in my breakfast, and with the nuts and seeds, because the microbiome, the good bacteria like that. Essentially it's a good prebiotics. And so that's what I have people focus on. A lot of salads, have your protein with every meal so you feel full. One of the things that Joelle, my daughter-in-law, who's co-wrote that chapter with me, we really try to make it so that it's enjoyable. I don't want so Dr. Cohn or any of my patients say, "Oh, I can't go out for dinner with my friends because I'm on the Candida diet." No, that's a lose-lose situation. You're making somebody antisocial and not enjoying life. But the good news is you can go to that restaurant, order a beautiful salad, have a nice piece of fish or meat. You don't, it's
Yeah,
options,
I agree. I think it's preparing a little bit ahead of time and also just knowing this is not forever.
Right. And it's not forever, because when you're feeling better, you can expand. Look, I know even myself, I tell patients this because I'm very honest. I said, look, I cheat, but I don't do it too many days in a row. That's for sure, because I don't start to feel great. I pull back, and it's a tug of war. I mean, that's the way I can put it. But it is great in the beginning, though, if you do stick with it. And I'm able to do, as you do with all your patients, do a program like this. I mean, I just the changes I see are miraculous. I mean, I had one guy, I can remember just now off the top of my head. He's been having itching for 3 years. And I actually didn't initially think it was Candida. We were like focusing on his environment and this and that, whatever. And then I really started to dig deeper. And then he had, according to the questions, some things that I realized would apply to him. And he was a little skeptical himself, and he loved socially drinking. He used to drink like 3 or 4 times a week. He's just this guy likes, he has a nice life, likes going out socially. And I said, "Look, you got to give me a little time here to work on you." But within 3 weeks, his itching disappeared completely. So he and I were both amazed at the same time.
Yeah, that's the beauty.
You know.
So how long do you have, patients always ask, how long am I going to have to stay
Yeah,
on this
that
diet?
is the first question. How long do I have to do this for? Well, look, I tell them, look, the first 4 to 6 weeks is definitely a good time to be as strict as possible. Then we start to expand. I like, what's it called, the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule. Try to be good 80% of the time. And 20% of the time you could cheat. Just try not to invert that law and be good only 20% of the time and bad 80%, because that can happen. And I also tell patients this too, because I'm honest. I say to them, I actually like going to the supermarket. I like shopping and, for food, not for clothes. And I tell patients this. I said, the real decision making goes on in the supermarket. If I'm going by the supermarket aisle and I'm pulling out the things, whether it's cheeses or this and that too, I say, "Oh, I'm just going to have a little bit." It's gone by the end of the week. But on the other hand, if I don't pick it and it's 10 o'clock at night and I'm searching my fridge for something and it's not there, I am not running out to the supermarket at 10. I'm too lazy to go buy it. So shopping, and we have a shopping list in there, is important. But I'm impressed. Some of my patients are really very good about all this. So.
Do you differentiate between, fresh and aged
Oh
cheeses,
yeah, big time. Oh, thanks for bringing that up. I think when people say, "Oh gosh, I really love cheese," Well, no, cottage cheese actually is a better choice. It's a little bit more water content. It actually also is more casein and not lactose. What people don't realize, like why also we tell them to avoid milk, is that, milk is in a way a sugar. All those things biochemistry wise, OSes, they lactose, fructose, all that, OSes are sugars, which again feed the Candida.
Last question. What, in your opinion, is the key to really conquering Candida?
I think it's the dedication to wanting to get better. I mean, we all know this in everything. If you don't want, if you're like, "Oh, if you're ignoring it, no, this can't be the reason," or you're not interested in following like a protocol like this, it's not going to work. That's for sure. The second thing is, which is wonderful, if you have a friend, a family member, somebody that supports you through this, so you're not going at it alone and you're not isolated. I think the third thing, which is really, really important, is to find a healthcare provider that believes you and that's familiar with this. And the good news is there are more and more practitioners that are, because nothing, like we talked about earlier on, disappoints a patient more than their doctor not believing them. It gives them their own self-doubts. And I'm hoping my book will be a nice guide that they could work with their local doctor with. And I do also encourage people. I've really, one of the only big benefits I've seen of social media, because I don't do a lot with that, but if you find a community online where people share supporting one another, I think that could be a really good thing.
Oh, and they're definitely out there for Canada. They're absolutely out there. Well, I hope the listeners have found this topic interesting. And if they or a loved one have chronic symptoms unresolved that sound like they may have Candida, please read this book and get educated. And well, Dr. Mitchell, I just want to finally say that you are finally the smartest doctor in the room.
No, it took 5 years. I'm only saying that it's on my guess. But I'll tell you, Dr. Cohen, you did such a good job that if I ever decide I need a break once in a while, you're going to be the first person I call to fill in. You're my
It's
Joan
my
Rivers
first
to
time
Johnny
hosting. I
Carson.
loved it.
All right, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.